You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
This is Solange Ellis, founder of Stable Riding, and this is episode 9 of Stable Riding with Solange, part of Horses in the Morning. I'm here the fourth Tuesday of every month to talk to you all about the rider and how we can make ourselves better in the saddle. When I look at the horse world in general, sometimes I see high school lunchroom tables, little cliques and groups, often separated by breed and discipline. The saddlebred people rarely hang out with the quarter horse people. The dressage riders aren't always chilling with the gated horse trail riders. Plenty of off-the-track thoroughbred hunter riders have never even sat on a Morgan. For a professional trainer to even attempt to be monetarily successful, they often need to hyper-specialize in on one type of competition, which means if not a single breed of horse, a single type of horse. So the riders who end up at those trainers' barns, usually by virtue of location, they end up having that same hyper-specific experience in their education and riding, which keeps us isolated and prevents us from simply riding, from being a human on a horse, regardless of the breed we are on or the saddle we are in. Sometimes I'll be in public in visibly obvious riding clothes, and I'll be asked if I ride. I get clocked often by Starbucks baristas. When asked if I ride, I always just smile and say, yep. And if they ask what kind of riding I do, because just riding, generally, isn't really an acceptable answer, I say, I fox hunt, because I do. When I have the time to go to an event, which is less frequently now that I've formally launched stable riding as a system, I go hunting. Why do I hunt? And why, of all the different horse activities I have done, has hunting been the one I like the most? Simple. It's not boring. See, dear listener, I get bored, and not a little, bigly. I get bigly, impossibly, crushingly bored. And most horse competitions and shows are repetitive. And while many riders thrive in that environment, I do not. I started hunting at the age of 17 on Labor Day in 2002. I met the master of the Chagrin Valley Hunt, Dick Desberg, by chance. See, I had had his retired first field master horse named Pochine. Pochine was my first true heart horse. A lady had come to my barn, recognized Pochine, and called Dick. Pochine had also been Dick's heart horse, and he'd lost track of him once he had retired him to a family friend. A week later, Dick and Pochine had a real Hallmark movie reunion, and Dick invited me out hunting just 7 days later. A frantic time ensued, as I had none of the clothes required, and I had to wake up at 2:15 a.m. to drive to the other side of Cleveland to meet Dick and his big horse, Beamish, who I was to ride that day. We hunted at 6 a.m., and after only 10 minutes, just a few riders behind the huntsman, I was hooked. I spent the next few months getting a truck and a trailer and preparing all my horses, and I became a subscriber in 2003 and hunted seriously 3 days a week. One season at a dinner at the hunt, I was given an award for the most different horses hunted in one season. That year, I hunted 25 different horses total. See, every single hunt is different. The weather and the seasons change, affecting the terrain and the scenting for the hounds. What hounds come out changes based on a multitude of factors. Different riders come out. I personally ride many different horses, and I also bring different students with me on sometimes different horses. The endless variety is exactly what I need to keep going back. And if I ever do get a little bored, I take a different horse or a new rider, or I can ride in a different field, or I can ride side saddle. Or one time I rode without my stirrup leathers and irons. Shout out to Jocelyn for forgetting hers. I have hours and hours of hunt stories I could tell, ranging from hilarious to so sweet it would make you cry. But we don't have that kind of time. Maybe one day that will be its own podcast. I think now our time is best spent with me answering the questions that I tend to always get about hunting, in case you don't know too much about the sport. We do not carry guns. There are live hunts where the hounds chase actual foxes that live naturally in that area. And then there are drag hunts where the hounds follow a preset course of fox urine. Here in the U.S., the goal is to chase the fox until it runs out of the area with which we are allowed to hunt in, or until it goes down into its den. In 24 years of hunting, I've only ever once been on a hunt where the hounds actually caught the fox. It does look exactly like all the old paintings. There's a horn, hounds, and people with red coats on. Fox hunting does have some specific terms, which you might hear in the upcoming interview, so I'm just going to give you a quick little rundown of the basics. Hounds are always called hounds and never dogs. The fixture is the location that you're allowed to be hunting in that day. The huntsman, who can be a woman, is the one with the horn and manages and hunts the hounds. The huntsmen have riders who assist in keeping track of the hounds sort of on the periphery, and those riders are called whipper-ins, whom we call whips. And whenever I watch a political drama and they talk about the majority whip and whipping the votes, I think it might have come from fox hunting. The riders are separated into groups called fields or flights. Each hunt structures their fields slightly differently. The hunt that you will hear me and my guest talk about today is my home hunt, the Rocky Fork Headley Hunt in Columbus, Ohio. Their fields work like this. First field is walk, trot, canter, jumping, and galloping. The second field is walk, trot, canter, with maybe a little bit of a gallop, and sometimes the field master in second flight will go, you can pop this fence if you want. The third field is walk and trot primarily, with a smidge of canter here and there, if everybody agrees to it. Each field of riders has a leader called the field master. I spent many seasons in my early 20s as second flight field master of the Chagrin Valley Hunt. That was some of the most fun I had out hunting, as it added a serious level of complexity. Being a field leader is a tremendous responsibility. You need to keep everyone moving, happy, and entertained, while also keeping them safe and comfortable. You cannot get lost, while also not interfering with the hound work or the movement of the other fields. A well-run hunt is a beautiful, wild, and flowing ballet of humans, horses, and hounds. And when it all comes together, there is nothing else quite like it. There seems to be two distinctive social vibes in horses. The exclusive, intimidating group of riders and cliques that make it hard to break into, and the opposite. The groups of riders with whom you are always instant friends, and there's always food and laughs and stories. I can personally say that the majority of fox hunters are the latter. They are some of the most gracious, helpful, and hospitable people you will ever hang with, for real. Rocky Fork in particular has been so wonderful to my family. My daughter started hunting them when she was 6 on her mini pony, plus all the riders who I have brought out over the seasons. I've made some real friends in the field, and one who always stands out is Valerie. When I think of her, I think of an incredibly polished rider and lady. Every aspect of her horsemanship is dialed in. Her tack is clean, correct, and perfectly fitted. Her horse is always immaculate and in peak weight and condition. Her turnout is always classic and elegant. She's never without the biggest smile and the most gracious attitude ever. I just adore her. Being an avid fox hunter, Valerie is the perfect guest for today's episode. She is also the rider who, by chance, ended up directly behind me on one of the wildest rides of my hunting career, a challenging morning on my favorite bad pony of all time, Pickles. Valerie, hello. Welcome and thank you for taking the time to be on the pod.
Thank you.
I've really been looking forward to this, as every time I start thinking about our discussion today, I remember that day that I rode in front of you on my favorite world's worst bad pony, Pickles. Can we start there? Do you remember watching me on Pickles that day?
That is a memory burned in my forever.
My pony, Pickles, decided to go like full level 10, pick up the red phone, shaky bananas crazy at the very beginning of a hunt. And somehow in the process of me like leaping off of her, falling down once I landed, getting back on her, and then continuing to hunt her, I ended up directly in front of you, Valerie, and you just had front row seats to one of the craziest hunts of my career.
I would say Pickles was using challenging behavior to express her feelings of the day.
Pickles has large opinions, and I like a clear communicator in a horse. I want to know where they stand. And Pickles always really tells me where she stands. But it was, I had a blast. That was one of the most fun hunts I've ever been on.
Agreed.
That's why she's my favorite horse. Okay, Valerie, are you ready for the questions? I'm so excited.
Yes, I'm excited too.
Can I ask you your age now and how long you've been riding for?
I am currently 67 years old, and Lord willing, I will be 68 on my birthday in July. And I have been riding for about 30 years.
I'll
meaning
tell you what,
I started when I was 36.
You look so absolutely incredible. You should tell everyone because you should be proud of it.
Thank you.
But you blow me away, man. Okay. What brought you to horses, and then what brought you into hunting?
Well, strangely enough, I grew up in the city in Cleveland, Ohio, and only rode a farm horse occasionally when we went down to Alabama during the summers. But fast forward, in my 30s, my father was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer, and we spent some time on the beach exploring what life meant. And in that moment, Dad asked me, "Valerie, what haven't you done with your life that you still want to do?" And I have to tell you, all I said was, "Dad, I have my health, my life, my family, my career, my education. The only thing I could want is more time with you." And he said, "Valerie," he said, "the living years are very short. It doesn't matter whether you get 50, 70, or 100. You should do something every day to enjoy the gift of life." He said, "Smell the coffee, smell the roses." So in that moment, I don't know how it popped into my head. I said, "Dad, I think I'd like to ride a horse." And he said, "That's it. And I want you to do that for me." So I have to say that in death, my father gave me and my daughter a gift that has sustained me in life.
Man, what an absolutely incredible story. That's so amazing, Valerie.
Unbelievable. It just popped into my head.
And he was right and you were right. This was what you were supposed to do. That's just amazing.
I found my tribe.
So you came into riding as an adult, and not everybody does. A lot of us start really young. So my question is, how was your experience coming into riding in your 30s?
I think the prevailing feeling at that time was anxiety. I had never been around fauna that large. And so I would go to the barn, large fauna.
Large fauna.
We're talking hippo, elephant, moose, elk, horse, cow.
Large fauna. Yep.
Large fauna. And I would just go to the barn to acclimate, to desensitize to their movements, their grunting, their breathing, because all of that, I had no idea what it meant. And so I had a lot of anxiety. But part two, I also had excellent instruction, and I was put on fabulous old school masters.
Oh, the
and
best.
Every time I got on one, the trainer would say, "This one is going to teach you a lot." So I was allowed to be student and learn and be on tolerant schoolmasters who taught me a lot.
Yeah. It's interesting when you say that, because I've been around horses since I was 5. So I'm so used to them being big and loud, you know, and clunking their water buckets and, you know, swishing their tails and making all the noises they make. But every once in a while, I'll have a beginner in the barn and one of the horses will urinate. And they'll go, "What's that sound?" And I'm like, "That's them peeing." And they're like that? And I'm like, "Yeah, haven't you always heard the saying about, you know, how an old racehorse pees?" But it's so true. It's a very different visual environment, physical environment, audio environment. And I think that us professionals who are inundated in it so consistently forget that when you're coming into it from the outside, sometimes you got to give people a minute to sort of settle in, because it is really very different.
I appreciate that, Solange. And with that note, also settle in and help us learn more on the ground, right?
Yes.
Understanding so much about the relationship that forms on the ground before you ever put a foot in the stirrup.
Yeah, my lessons are an hour. And when I was teaching in the beginning, sometimes the parents would be like, well, how long are the lessons? And I'm like, they're an hour. But I book a solid 15 minutes at the beginning and the end for your kid to help me get the horse out of the stall, put him in the cross ties, brush him, learn to tack him up. So you're going to ride 30 to like 45 minutes of that hour, because it's very important to me that I book that on the ground time at the beginning and the end, because I'd look at the parents and go, you know, if your kid gets on the horse and just stays up there, they can't really get to him. They're pretty safe. Like, as long as you don't fall off, the horse can't really get to you. But I said, on the ground, you can get bit, you can get stomped on, you can get kicked, you can get smushed. Yeah. One of my worst concussions was getting hit in the face by the head of my oldest, calmest school horse, because he was napping and I went in his stall to take his water bucket out and I shocked him and he woke up and threw his head up and hit me right in the face.
That's, you know, what I'm talking about.
Yes. Yes. So having that on the ground time is so important. And sometimes it's hard for a facility to structure that into their program. And then it becomes detrimental to the riders later in their education because they don't know what to do.
I'm so glad we were able to talk about that. I think it's one of the most important. And I still go outside and pull up a chair and sit there and just bond with Gorn. Mm-hmm. All of our interactions are not transactional. Every time I go, he doesn't have to do something. I have love visits 4 or 5 times a week.
Yes. Everyone could, husbands. You could write that down.
Love visits 4 or 5 yes, times
a week. Love visits 4 or 5 times a week. Non-transactional, just adoration. We can handle that.
Love it.
I like to say that everybody hunts for a very different reason, because we really all do. Fox hunting brings people, so many different people from so many different backgrounds, because there's so many different reasons that you can want to participate in the sport. Some love hunting. Some love hounds. Some are passionate about land conservation and nature. Some riders just like really going fast. Some riders really like the fashion. I have hunted with some riders who love flasks of hard liquor at dawn. What about hunting do you love, Valerie? What makes you such a committed fox hunter?
Well, all that you mentioned, except for maybe going fast, is one of the things I think. I think what I love most about fox hunting is that when I'm on top of my horse, I feel like a centron, right? A centurion. Mm-hmm. We are just together. Mm-hmm. And in that space, I love being in nature, be it the water, the field, the wood. And in that moment, it feels so spiritual to me. Yeah. I feel like I'm in church.
Yes.
So for me, riding is like going to church. Hunt fox hunting is riding is like going to church.
And that's so crazy, because I feel the exact same way. I always, when I take my students hunting, and often it's autumn time here in northeastern Ohio when we have our main season. So the leaves fall from the trees partway through, and now you'll be going down like a heavily wooded path, like a little narrow corridor. And the trees grow up, and the stark, empty, leafless branches sort of arc above you. And it always reminds me of like the buttresses of a cathedral.
Wow. That was a beautiful picture. That's how it feels.
Mm-hmm. It really is. I wish that everybody would try it, because it's such an incredible experience.
Amen. I agree. And then the other parts that I love, in addition to that, are clearly my riding friends and partners. The opportunity to ride on different terrain. I grew up in the show world, so getting out and not, I'm ring sour. So getting out with my horse outside of the ring means a lot to me. And I enjoy understanding how to negotiate the terrain safely and correctly. And then having a mount who equally does it. All those are the important aspects. I love the fact that we hunt the beautiful hounds, and I love watching them work and hearing their music. Mm-hmm. But I have to be honest, the fashion probably is number 2 for me.
Well, girl, you always look great. Like, you always, your outfits are endlessly on point.
And it's an opportunity to look good on a good looking animal. So what's to lose there, right? All win.
Well, you know, it's very visually stunning. And it's why when you go to museums and antique malls, there's so many prints of painted hunt scenes, because when people saw it, it was so moving to them at that time. Maybe you were a rural farmer, you were far from, you know, any big culture. Maybe you've never been to the opera or the ballet, but the hunt came through, and the hunt coming through was such a spectacle that people painted it. Like, that's the visual impression it gives. And it's one of the few things that really looks the same. You know, you could go fox hunting today and see a scene that looks exactly like something that was painted 200 years ago, other than maybe somebody's got their iPhone on their belt, you know?
Isn't that amazing?
It's really incredible. It's really a little part of living history when you think about it.
Amazing.
I talk to a lot of non-fox hunters in my job and in my business, and I find that their interpretation of the sport is that it's very expensive, very exclusionary, and very snooty. And while the horse world is indeed a stunning cornucopia of personalities, on the whole, I find hunting to be actually really none of those things at all. A subscription for a season can be equal to or less than some big fancy weekend shows people attend. The riders truly now love new people in the field because they're really passionate about their sport and they want to share it. And any breed of horse, really at any age, can be a good hunt mount. Having been an avid hunter for so long, what has your experience been traveling and hunting with so many different packs?
Solange, that's a very interesting question. So it does vary around the country in terms of the people that you meet who are in the hunt. Some are old world, old money, whose families have put together the acreage and acres of land that we're hunting on. Mm-hmm. And so they have a certain point of view about the sport. And then, but what I find is fox hunting can really be one of the most accessible equine experiences. It doesn't take a big, fancy, expensive horse. It just takes a steady, sound, smart one. And I find the people are very, very friendly because it's not that high-end show world necessarily. And it's a mix. People have done that in their lives, perhaps, and have now turned to the fox hunting. A lot of eventers come to fox hunting. Yes. But what I really find is it's an across-the-age, completely accessible English discipline. And I'm so glad we're having a chance to chat about it because not a lot of people really know and understand that. From pony riders to pony club, all the way up to some of our masters and leaders of the hunt are in their 70s and some have been in their 80s because equestrian is a sport that you can do pretty much throughout and across the lifespan. And it can be a good sport for adults and seniors as well.
I couldn't agree more. That's exactly what I've experienced too. We know that all riders love their horses. Fox hunters, though, in particular, I find have a very strong bond with their mount because of sometimes the situations and the terrain that you navigate together. Can you tell the listeners a little about your current hunt horse? Goran is a very impressive gentleman, and anyone who has ever met him will definitely remember him because it's like meeting an old silver screen movie star.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. But he truly is.
Yes.
So Goran is a rehome from New Vocations Thoroughbred Rescue, for starters. And so he is an off the track giant. I still think of him as my baby, even though he's turning 11.
That's a really big horse, Val.
Thoroughbred, Bay Thoroughbred. He's a tall, handsome, tall, dark, handsome drink of water. Mm-hmm. He has incredible breeding. And I think that's why you get that regalness about him.
Yes.
And Goran started, he raced till he was three due to a paralyzed flap. He was retired from racing. I do note that he survived Santa Anita and he came to New Vocations, Kentucky. I found him within a month or so of him arriving there. And it was something about his At Liberty video that completely captivated me, my trainer at the time, and my best friend. And when I sent his At Liberty video to the two of them, it immediately became girls' trip to Lexington. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. Goran has a very good brain, and that's one of the reasons. And people ask me, how big is he? And I always have to say, size and money are relative. But just to put it into perspective, I stopped formally measuring Goran, like with a stick, when he got to 17.1. I figure I had enough information. And that was a few years ago. He's big.
He's big.
He's big. That's enough said.
I remember when I rode him, I sat on him and I went, oh yeah, this is how a horse that fits me feels.
Yeah, your leg, it was beautiful.
Yeah, I was like, oh yeah, I guess this is how normal people feel on their horses. Is there one particular moment or memory about hunting that you'd like to share with the listeners? We all have so many magical moments in the field, so I know it can be hard to pick, but I was hoping you could share just one.
And I've had several different mounts in the hunt field. And so I was just trying to fast forward, since we were talking about Gorn, to a moment with him. I think one of my most memorable moments with Gorn is when we like to ride third field. I just retired from a very high pace, high stress, high intensity job.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It feels wonderful. And so when I fox hunt, that is one of the times, because I lesson, I trail ride, that I like to just take in, smell the coffee and smell the roses.
Yeah.
And I don't want it to rush by so fast. I want to really be able to just amble along and take it all in. And even in third field, there are moments where we're catching up to the field and we're on the go, right?
Oh, yes.
We have to move out. Yep, mm-hmm. We have to move out. So there's no doubt about it. I think one of my favorite memories is when we went to do a joint meet down in Camargo with the Camargo hunt in Kentucky. And there, I had never seen a field that large. There had to be 75 horses in the field.
Yeah.
And it stretched across a huge, I have a photo of it. I plan to frame it. All of us in that beautiful attire, just like out of a picture. Mm-hmm. And Gorn was, obviously I was riding Gorn, and he was so excited to be moving out across huge terrain. And it was the first time when he was in an extended trot. We were keeping up with the field that was moving out across a huge field. I can't even say how many acres it was. That territory is 10,000 contiguous acres. So we were
crazy?
Moving out massively. And I remember all I could do was hunker down into a low 3-point position, grab mane. And Gorn was stretching out and covering the ground so fast. It was just the most exhilarating moment in his trot,
yes,
his extended
yes.
trot. It was the most exhilarating moment of my life.
Yes.
I also remember at the end of that hunt, when I got off, I couldn't walk. My legs were jello.
You used up all your muscles. You used up all your muscles. When I taught little kids, I used to say, did you bring your muscles today? And the answers would vary from, no, I brought zero muscles. They're under my bed. And then I'd say, did you bring your leg muscles today? And they'd go, I brought 10,000. And I'd be like, I don't know if I can handle that many muscles.
I love that. It does require it, right? A level of fitness. But that surreal moment of feeling that giant thoroughbred with his magnificent movement underneath me, covering that ground, it was a sensation, is really what I'm trying to get to. It was a sensation. It's not like the sensation of flying when you're jumping something, but it was definitely a sensation of, oh, sailing. It
yes.
felt like sailing.
I was at breakfast with my daughter a couple weeks ago, and I told her a story about one of the best, like true extended, like full dressage trots I ever sat. And I'd had dressage lessons for years. It was in the hunt field, and I was in the back of second field, and I was on Floyd, my little pony Floyd, who is my least favorite pony. Pickles is my most favorite pony. Floyd is my least favorite pony. And Floyd wanted to catch up via trying to buck me off and run away, and explain to him that we were in this together. So I was sitting his trot, and I was holding him back a bit so he wouldn't, you know, bust up into a canter. And he busted out the most incredible extended trot around this whole perimeter of this cornfield. It felt like right before a plane takes off. You know how their nose
yes.
lifts up?
Yes.
And I remember going, wow, out of this fat little pony.
He's fabulous.
But you know what he had? He had impulsion, the bottom of the training pyramid, because Floyd's like, I got to get where I'm going. We're going to get eaten by wolves.
Wow.
But it was, I remember feeling that on him. But of course, he's 14-1. So I can't even imagine the sensation of feeling it on Gorin. That's got to be really incredible.
It was like sailing, mm-hmm. picking up a strong wind and letting it rip. And he was just loving it. And I was loving it. And we were together, right? We
yes.
were so tight and together. It was beautiful.
We knew each other and rode together for many seasons before I had the opportunity to travel down to where you keep Gorin and give you a few stable riding sessions when you were rehabbing from a fall. As a rider who has both ridden in the hunt field and spent so much time in the hunter show ring, I'd love to hear your perspective on the differences between the real world riding I specialize in and the position in the show ring, as well as how those two styles can really inform and help to support each other.
Powerful question, Solange, and thank you so much. One of the things that I really became to realize was that I wish I had had the stable riding technique at the beginning of my riding career.
I hear that often.
No. Yes. I, took my share of falls because the English position is a forward, seat.
Light seat. It's very light seat.
Yep. And it's forward. And depending on your confirmation, that can either be a detriment or a help. And so I have taken my share of falls. But the thing about the falls for me is I guess I'm one of those crazy horse girls. I love riding so much that I generally tend to pop back up and get on and later go home and realize, oh, I got a couple broken fingers dangling there or whatever it may be. And so that's the first thing in terms of the difference, because what you shared with me and what you share with everyone in your work is this ability to, like I call it, sit a little trouble.
Yes.
When you are on a horse, they are not a machine. While somewhat predictable, they are still a sentient being with their own thinking and feeling.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And ability to behave and behavior. And so while we try to be tight and tidy, things happen. Deers pop out on top of you in the field. Yes. Something startles them, right? Things happen.
Yes.
And so I say, you've got to be good enough, stable enough to sit a little trouble when you're on a horse. And if you can't do that, then this might not be the sport for you. Mm-hmm. And you are going to come off, and people, oh, I don't want to fall off. And I'm like, that's not realistic. You have Correct. Left the ground, and at some point in your encounter, you're going to meet the ground. It's just the reality of it. And so what we try to do and you try to do is manage all of that, trying to give us the best skill set to not leave, right, to not hit the ground, to have the skills of when you do come down, how to fall. And all of that is a part of it. And I wish people had your package earlier. So that's the main thing. And then secondly, while I feel that I have a modified position now based upon your wonderful dissection of the biomechanics of me and my horse. Mm-hmm. I have a certain body. I am not a typical body size rider. I am athletic. I'm fit. I'm older. And my horse is huge. He's huge in leg. He's huge in neck, shoulder, head, and scapula.
Yes.
And so you really aligned my mental and physical awareness of where I need to be on Gorn to ride as safely and stable and as stable as possible. And Solange, I'm going to drop a tear. And for that, I am eternally grateful.
Val, you're going to make me cry on my own podcast now.
That's real.
Well, Val, I love you.
I love you.
I know. And also, you are such a beautiful rider and you have a fabulous horse who's perfect for you, who you take impeccably perfect care of. Like Gorn is a shining example of what a horse can be. And you just needed like a little help. I always say it's like putting the couch on the other side of the room. You just move the couch and it's like you bought a new house. And it was very
easy. You did. You tweaked me. There were the tweaks. You did. It was tweaks.
Yeah.
It was tweaks. But they were so important. My foot position, Gorn has got a lot of impulsion. Yes. So his trot, some people would call it bouncy. He has huge impulsion.
Dynamic. He's a dynamic mover. Yes.
Yes. Springs. Mm-hmm. And so being able to understand how to manage that, I was always using the old method of letting the trot throw you up, the motion. Right. And I remember you said, Valerie, I could never post him very stably.
I remember this.
So he learned, we taught him what was called the piddly trot. And thank you for my previous trainer for teaching Gorn to do a piddly trot for his old lady mama.
Yes.
But with you, I was able to trot his, post his authentic trot, and he is so happy and be with him. Mm-hmm. So that was an important tweak. Mm-hmm. The other critical tweak was my leg position, understanding that it's okay to have it a bit out in front. Yes, heel under hip is fine, but in terms of sitting a little trouble and being out in real world situations, out on the trail and other places, my foot is out in front, lady.
Well, you have beautiful legs. Like you have the legs of a rider. You have beautiful legs. So you might as well use them. It's a gift God gave you. Yeah, use those legs.
And then lastly, I'm a large breasted woman, so I have a lot of dynamics in front, and you really helped me to find center.
Yes.
It took us a few lessons for me to feel that I was on the vertical. It always felt that I was behind, and you're like, nope, you're not even on vertical yet.
Yes.
I'm like, oh goodness.
I'm in the works planning a future pod episode from big chested ladies, and I'm trying to think of a very appropriate title.
We'll work on that together.
I teach a lot of them, and it really alters your center of mass. I mean, riding's it's a mathematical equation. It's a physics problem, right? And that's something that I do not possess in the least, but other women do.
Yes, yes, yes. We all have our differences.
We all have our differences.
And so those three things were the big key to my being more safe and leading to most recently when I was on Gorin and he had a huge startle. The staff were doing some cleaning in an upstairs viewing area and dropped some cleaning equipment down an interior stairwell. And Gorin, Gorin shot straight up. Now, this is why he's a good horse. He shot so far up. I meant to ask my trainer who was there. I just remember seeing her eyes bug out. so you know it's not good. I mean, it was at least 6 feet. I'm sure it was more, but it was at least 6 feet straight up on a 17 hand horse. And in his, you know, they go down for a quick second and then they spring up. Mm-hmm. And I was not wearing a safety vest that day. However,
that's always how it goes.
Oh my gosh. When you think about it, but I was very put together because of the things you taught me. And I remember when he shot up, my feet, they even shot probably further out in front. And I remember locking my core. I left the saddle because of the aerodynamic of a giant equine, right? 1200 pound
large
animal.
Large fauna.
Jumping that far up. It thrust me up out of the saddle, maybe 2 to 3 feet itself, but because he's a good horse, he didn't, you know, shake, rattle, rock and roll. He just came straight down.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Straight down. And so I came straight down back into the position in the tack, sitting perfectly erect. And I remember my trainer saying, "Val, my other riders would not have been able to sit that." Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I was like, "Solange, if not just having saved my life, certainly just saved me from going to the hospital." And I was in perfect position when I came down out of that little trouble that Gorin shot me that day.
All the emergency room doctors that I've met have always been so nice, but that does not mean I went to go see them. They're always so sweet and professional and good at their job. And I'm like, "Man, you're wonderful. Can I never see you again?"
Ever. I was so grateful to you that day. If I had been in the previous position that I would ride in, that thrusting of a movement would have shot me forward, would have snatched me forward and sent me any violently down. And I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that I had your technique and I was able, it was second nature. And when I came back down, I was like, "Well, okay."
I tell all the women I teach, I go up to them, I put my hand on their leg when they're riding and I go, "We're too pretty to fall on our faces." I'm like, "We're too pretty. We can't fall on our face. We're too pretty. We're too beautiful to fall off this horse." That's what I tell all of them.
I thank you. Thank you. And I was so proud of my boy because when startled, he could have bolted. He could have spun. Yeah, he could have said,
Western
"You're out of here."
Spook in place.
Yes.
Spook, but then pause and refer to my rider for what's the next step. You know,
he did that. And that's why I love that horse.
That's the relationship you have with him too, though. Gorin's a great guy. Like, I don't want
to
diminish
Gorin's
abilities. But also, you should take equal amount of credit for the partnership that you've built with him as his owner and rider. Because you've worked really hard at it, Val, and you deserve to be proud of it.
Thank you. I do. It is a source of pride for me. Mm-hmm. He whinnies hard when he sees me, and he knows that some days we're going to work, some days we're going to play, some days we're going to be in the salon, and some days, right, we're just going to chill. And all of it, he's game. He's so game.
What advice would you give to a rider who's interested in trying out fox hunting? Let's see if we can make any converts here on the pod.
Do it. It's nothing to be afraid of. It's a beautiful trail ride type experience.
Yes.
If you just have basic riding clothes, we understand when people that are trying it out might not have all the fox hunting regalia. Mm-hmm. It is not necessary when you're just a guest and trying.
Yes.
And I would say if you're a rider, open yourself to new experiences. Because yes. Once bitten, you'll never forget it. And it'll be something that you'll always want to have a little taste of in your life. I've been in the hunt since 2011. So that has me, 15 years? Mm-hmm. And I don't see that changing in the near future. Because of my age, I'm looking for how I can stay involved with horses as I across the lifespan. And as I said, one of our field masters was 80 years old, still leading.
Oh, yes.
Leading a field. Mm-hmm. And as we know, many of our Olympians are in their 50s and 60s. And it takes that kind of years to really be at that level, right?
Oh, yeah.
And sure so, does. No, horses are something you can do well into your middle and senior years, and you can do horses safely.
This was an amazing conversation, Val. Thank you so much for being on the pod. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, and I'm so grateful to you, Solange, for all that you did for me and all that you do for the field, It is really an incredible contribution you're making.
As I reflect on my two decades of hunting, two things really stand out to me. The first is it can give a horse a job who maybe wouldn't have one otherwise. And not only can that horse have that job, if that horse is good at it and likes it, that horse will be prized beyond belief. I'm going to tell you a story about Rex, a gray standardbred pacer who was given to me when he was nearly 20. One day my cell rang and I answered to a woman crying hysterically. And through tears, she tells me that I was the 10th barn she was calling. And if 10 barns said no, she's going to have to put down the horse that she had as she could no longer keep him. Now, I've always loved standardbreds and I agreed to take him sight unseen over the phone. His race name was Elm Street's Bozo, and I felt that was a little wordy. So in the trailer on the way home, he became Rex. I remember watching her walk him down her driveway to where I'd parked my two-horse trailer on her tiny little street and saying out loud, "He's white!" I'd never met a gray standardbred before. Rex had been a pacer at the track until he was 10, and then he retired, and they'd given him to a friend to hang out in their yard. But the house was being sold and Rex had become homeless. And there's not always a booming market of people looking for older, unbroke ex-cart horses who pace. I broke Rex to saddle easily and he truly became the cornerstone of my program. He took everyone on their first trail ride and everyone on their first fox hunt. For nearly 10 years, if I loaded up my horse trailer to go anywhere, Rex was in it. He became my designated ride-along horse and came with me every time I ever moved a horse anywhere so they'd have a nice, calm buddy in the trailer with them. He was the pasture saint and could go out with anyone. He never threw a shoe, was never too fat or too thin. He never broke his halter and never pooped in his water bucket. He was perfect. On paper, though, he was not perfect at all. See, Rex paced and trotted and sometimes cantered. And sometimes a little of all three. He never once cantered on his left lead, and he was basically incapable of anything shaped like a circle, and a frame, outline, or headset was not in his wheelhouse. He had maybe lateral leg aids, but not really. And I could not have cared less. I mean, I had been given a free horse who I broke a million years into his life, who I could put literally anyone on and stick them behind me and trust him totally. He stood at checks, let hounds run between his legs, let whips gallop by and traversed mud, hills, ditches, and the road with the calm of a Zen master. I have owned many horses, and I will own many more, but there will only ever be one Rex. Rex, who would have never ever made it in a single show arena, but was a legend in the hunt field. See, dear listener, the hunt field doesn't care about your horse's pedigree or the level of their dressage movements. You can be a janky old standee and excel. What I love about hunting on the horse's end is that the field cares about and values the horse's character. It can reward more who they are, not so much what they can do. And I really dig that. In a way, the same is true for the riders, which brings me to my second point about fox hunting. When I started my business, I chose not to pursue showing or competition riding at the time because my rider demographic was mainly young girls who were not very high income. And I could imagine them not being able to afford showing regularly or having the means to show competitively. From my background as a saddle seat equitation rider, I knew that often it can be a bit of a beauty contest in the show ring, and asking these young girls to allow themselves to be publicly judged on appearance didn't really sit well with me. The hunt field, on the other hand, you were rewarded for being polite, clean, and on time, for riding well and smart, for navigating the terrain, hounds, and other horses safely, for helping get gates and picking up dropped gloves. A 12-year-old girl could go out in a blazer from Goodwill and have a fantastic morning. They were able to succeed based on their choices, their attitude, and their manners, not on their appearance and income level. Every kid I ever took out hunting had a positive experience. And as an instructor and a mother, that means the world to me. The real-world nature of fox hunting makes it more accessible in a way. Groups of hounds, horses, and riders moving together along the open ground is about as natural as it gets. This is why, as an activity, it suits so many different types of horses and riders. In one hunt, I'll see thoroughbreds, warmbloods, draft crosses, Morgans, Tennessee Walkers, Paints, Frisians, Arabian Standardbreds, and all sorts of ponies, halflingers to Connemaras. It will often be the widest spectrum of breeds you're ever likely to encounter. As for the riders, man, you'll have little littles on lead lines, trail riders, eventers, jumpers, ladies who cross train with dressage, converts from the Western disciplines. You'll often see more men out hunting than at many horse shows. And age is definitely just a number at a fox hunt. Not only are many of the members in the field retirement age or above, often the staff is too. Field masters and huntsmen in their 60s is very common. My stance of all riders is reinforced in fox hunting. It's another reason I remain so committed to the sport. I thought long and hard about today's rider tip and homework. I wanted something that would be related to hunting, but can also be useful for any rider listening. Let's talk about stopping. I love a horse with a good, true halt transition. Not a ride to a walk, not a coast, a halt. I think that it's very important in a horse. In fact, as a trainer, I think stopping might be even more important than the going. One thing I consistently observe in riders, both in and out of the hunt field, is that they pull with their arms to stop their horse. Now, you might be thinking, well, duh, I use my reins to stop my horse. Of course I use my arms. The unfortunate trick of language when it comes to instructing riders is often in that very first lesson, we just resort to saying pull to stop, kick to go. And pull implies grabbing onto your reins with your hands and using your arm muscles to pull back. What happens over time is riders get this arm pull muscle memory, and it creates a mental association between their hands and arms and control. This is one of the driving factors in riders having difficulty keeping their hands down or their arms relaxed. The rider tip is the secret to stopping any horse. Stopping comes from your feet. I'm going to say that again. Stopping comes from your feet, which means when you're ready to perform a full halt transition, especially at speed, like in the hunt field, you put your feet in front of you. And then you close your hands around the reins, freezing your arms and hands into solid pieces attached to your torso. Then you sit down and lean back from your waist. What happens physically in your skeleton when you do this is your skeletal system and the muscles in your back and the weight of your body will create the pressure on your reins and ask the horse to halt. I call this back pulling versus the let me grab and bend my arms pulling motion. I call that arm pulling. If you're a light mass rider under 120 pounds, if you're a woman who does not have an overabundance of upper body strength, if you have short arms, if you have short arms and a full chest, if you have any arm, wrist, hand, shoulder, or neck injury, arm pulling will not work for you and will also be bad for your body. Back pulling will both work for you and be a sustainable option for your body. If you have a horse who can be sticky to stop, who gets strong in the bridle when they're having a good time, and you try an arm pull, well, then they just lean on you and they don't stop. But if you back pull, they will realize that they're pulling you into their own back and they slow down pretty quickly. The interaction is mechanical and it works universally on all horses, regardless of breed or conformation. It's pretty freaking awesome. For the horse, since the weight shift that accompanies putting your feet in front of you comes first in the process of stopping, through repetition, you can train them to halt at that weight shift. I require all my horses to have a weight and vocal triggered halt aid at the walk, trot, and canter before I will take them trail riding, jumping, or I will fox hunt them. This makes things much safer for all parties involved. Plus, it's so nice to have a horse who stops when I just sit down and say whoa with my mouth. So my rider homework is, you guessed it, practice stopping your horse. Spring is here. The weather's getting warm. Zoomies may be happening. And the first few outings of 2026 are either happening or just around the corner. It seems like now would be a great time to check our brakes as riders. If you have been in the habit of arm pulling, it might take you some time to retrain yourself out of that forward-leaning, pulling fetal position stop and into a more effective lengthening, leaning back, pulling habit. So as always, start at the walk. Your chin is up, your ribs are lifted, your feet go in front of you, your hands and arms freeze into solid sticks. Lean back, say whoa, and hold that pressure and position until your horse stops fully. Then release that pressure and reward your horse lavishly. Now is a place for treats if you use them, and I totally do. I would make it a point to practice stopping correctly at this walk at least 10 times per ride. You can spread them around so your horse isn't like, why are we stopping all the time? You can kind of sneak them in throughout the ride. Once you're happy stopping at the walk, move on to the trot and then the canter. The benefit of thinking stopping comes from my feet is you are training yourself to sit down and back to stop, which is the exact same position as the stable riding position I told you all about way back in the very first episode of this podcast in August of 2025. The stable position is also the stopping position. So when your horse moves out from under you unexpectedly, you will both be able to clearly communicate for them to slow down and keep yourself stable on their back, preventing a visit to see one of those pesky emergency room doctors. You can find our show notes and links to today's guests and podcasts in the show notes on your podcast player or on the website at stableriding.us. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as Stable Riding. We're here once a month on the fourth Tuesday of every month. We have our own open RSS feed. Just search Stable Riding with Solange in your podcast player, or you can find us on the main Horses in the Morning feed. All riders can be stable riders, and a stable rider makes for a happy horse.